Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Premium Investment Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Damien Chilney, Head of Investment Managers and Governance at Premium, one of Australia's leading specialist investment platforms. Today, we're heading into the world of private equity. With this asset class, one of the fastest growing areas of interest for all investors around the globe. Very fortunate to be joined by a leading expert in this field, with Jose Luis Gonzalez Pastor joining us from London via Madrid to walk us through some of the key issues in this space and work through some of the key strategies used by private equity investors, but sometimes little known, and that is we're going to talk about co-investments. And about our guest, Jose Luis Gonzalez Pastor is a managing director of Neuberger Berman in the private equity team and a senior member of the firm's private investment portfolio group, where he leads fund investments and direct co-investments. He has over 18 years industry experience through private equity and investment banking and has now been with Neuberger Berman for 11 years. And about Neuberger Berman, founded in New York in 1939 and today located in 26 countries around the world, employing over 2,800 staff, managing over US$450 billion. The private markets group was founded over 35 years ago and managed over $120 USD in assets for a range of institutions and private wealth investors around the globe. Jose Luis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And welcome to Melbourne as well. I hope you had a nice journey here.
Yeah, so far so good.
Good. And whilst we'll delve into the detail on co-investing as a strategy is the real focus of today, but it's worth covering off on some quick background around the private equity market. So let's talk about private equity. It continues to be one of the fastest growing areas for investment. So what are the major drivers for this increase?
Well, first and foremost, private equity continues delivering good returns over cycles, over periods of time. And when you have a year like 2022 where capital markets shown a lot of volatility, and again, you look at private equity performance in general, it was a very muted year. That's the other virtue. It has low volatility. So for investors having an asset class that delivers returns constantly with low volatility, it's very appreciated. Another thing that is happening these days is that there are more and more structures available for different type of investors, including high net worth individuals and retail investors. So now they have an alternative that before they were not having an access to it. So that's also important. And we also need to remember that from diversification perspective, public markets over time have fewer listed companies than before. Yeah. Companies take longer to get into market. Whereas in private markets, you can access a broader number of companies and a strategy. So it's also very compelling to have another layer of diversification in your allocation in your portfolios.
Sure. And I think there's an interesting stat around the number of US listed companies has been really reducing over time. Yeah.
First, because there are a lot of companies have been taken private.
Yes.
Private equity.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that many companies, they have chosen to stay private for longer.
Yeah.
There's more private capital that can fund the next growth stages of these companies at different levels. And some of them, honestly, they prefer not to have all the scrutiny and short-term views, I would say, of public markets.
Yeah.
So they prefer to try to lure a private market and long-term investors, which you can also find on the private sector or on the private equity side, like long-term funds, to stay private for longer.
Mm. So that's kind of, let's say that's the supply equation there. Let's talk about the demand equation as well, about allocations within portfolios. So what are you seeing in terms of like the weight of private equity in portfolios around the world and direction of where that's heading?
Yes. Well, it depends on the type of investors. I would say traditional private equity investors, which have been public pension funds and private pension funds, they keep allocating.
Yep.
Probably their stated target is anywhere between 5 to 10%. Usually they're a little bit underweight because it just take them time to ramp up their programs, but that's what they are targeting and depends on geographies. Probably insurance companies are the ones that have the lowest one, and probably it's driven a lot because of regulatory constraints, especially in Europe. But one area where the, I would say they are leading in terms of allocations are precisely endowments.
Yes.
We know the big universities in the U.S., they are close to 25%. Yale, Harvard as well, they are close to 25%. And family offices are also in the range of 15 to 25%.
Yeah.
Now, if we go back to the mass affluent market that they are starting from zero, we are having plenty of conversations with financial advisors these days. They're trying to first bring them to 5%, but the long-term
zero.
Goal, from zero.
Yeah.
And the long-term goal is to bring them to 15%. Mm. And part of the argument, which I also buy very much, is, look, we're talking about a pocket of capital, which is called equities. Mm. You can access it via public equities or private equity.
That's a really good run there. And I think, you know, the imperative, like a lot of people at zero and ramping up, and that's where I suppose the demand is there. And let's go through the major, well, I suppose there's three major types of transactions that you might get yourself involved in. So we've got primary, secondary, and co-investors. So for the listeners' benefit, just kind of go through how you may purchase a company.
True. So primaries in our world means to allocate capital to a third-party private equity fund. So we make a commitment and then they will be drawing capital over time to buy companies. So the actual manager of the companies, the ones that they are driving, they are in the driving seat, basically they are them. So we are allocating capital to different funds and we're looking for the best managers, obviously, over time and thinking that they can execute on that strategy. Secondaries means, there are two type of secondaries. There are the LP-led secondaries and they are the GP-led secondaries. Let me delve into both for a second. But secondaries, his names kind of directs us, is second-hand investment.
Yeah. That's second-hand. Yeah.
It's a second-hand investment, just for better or for a simple explanation. So if on primaries you have made the first original commitment to a fund, on secondaries you are buying from that existing investor and replacing him in the fund structure.
Yes.
That's the LP-led because the limited partner is selling the interest. The GP-led, that's also another way of second-hand. They have owned the asset in a fund structure and they want to move it to another fund structure. So they need to replace everything, basically. They need a new fund with new investors.
Yes.
And that's a GP-led driven because it's the GP, the general partner, who is driving that change.
Sure. And then we've got co-investors, the last one as well.
Correct.
And we'll talk a lot about that, but like what's the quick definition of a co-invest?
Co-investments means to invest in a company alongside the general partner, the one that we made the primary commitment, we were mentioning before. But you invest as a minority investor with minority protections. You're not managing the company either, but you're facilitating that the general partner is acquiring that company.
Sure. And so in that there, I think it's probably co-invest is maybe an area that people may not be familiar in. Probably on the primaries is when people think about private equity, that might be the most common one. But, Neuberg are probably early pioneers in the co-invest space as well and probably still one of the most active in this space. You know, how did this transaction type come about? Like, what was the origins out of all of this?
Yes. If I can do a little bit of history here.
Sure.
Early in the days, there was co-investments that were just not at the mainstream. Think about before the great financial crisis. So when a general partner needed more capital to complete a transaction, usually they invited one of their competitors to join forces. Now, during the great financial crisis, that didn't go very well because there were basically two chefs in the kitchen and they have different ways of, of different views of how to fix the problems. So since right after the great financial crisis, we saw a significant increase in co-invest because general partners realized that investors, limited partners like ourselves, were much more friendly passengers in their investments than could be a competitor. So that's the general framework. So usually the investments that we get involved with can come out of two ways. The first one, which is the most obvious one, they want to acquire a company and then they don't have enough capital and they call their largest limited partners, and we're one of them in many, many funds. The other one is that we proactively approach them with liquidity solutions for their portfolios in order for them to rebalance or manage the aging of the different companies, and at the same time providing some liquidity to their investors.
Sure.
So it can be a pull or a push, I would say, in that sense. So those are the two ways where we see co-investment opportunities. Yeah. And I would say on the one that we are more proactive, I would say whether we are more innovative and leading into the market, I think the vast majority of the market is more aware of the traditional, okay, this GP, they need some money for completing the this transaction, and then they ask for co-invest capital.
Yeah, okay. And then, again, so we've got three layers of primary, secondaries, and co-invest, but then I think even delving down into co-invest, you've got another set of layers or types of transactions. So you talked on some of them, like traditional being shortfall, but let's go through like some of the other types of transactions that could go in co-invest.
Yeah, well, we have the traditional and syndicated, as you mentioned before, but that's a very simple process, very articulated, very little capital available there. Where we can be really helpful, it's when we participate as a co-underwriters.
Yes.
So they are in a process. They need to place a bid with a price, with some terms. And in the meantime, they are organizing the third-party due diligence providers to provide them with all the reports. So we work alongside them. We receive the same reports at the same time. We attend the management presentations. We give them our views of the business and the pricing and the dynamics for them. But in the end, they decide what is the price to bid. But the important feature here, as a co on the right, is that they need our money for the final bid.
Yes.
They need our signature, if you will, and our capital. Usually to participate in this part of the market, you need probably to be around 100 million, able to speak for around 100 million dollars. So the number of co-investors in that space is relatively limited, as you can imagine. And we can speak up to 500 million. So we can flex our commitment. And that's very helpful for them because without our capital, they cannot even place the bid. Whereas on traditional syndication, look, they can stretch a little bit their fund. So it's not a big deal for them. But in this situation, either they have this additional co-invest capital or they cannot put the bid.
Yeah. And it's, I suppose, what's the direction or the amount of transactions you're doing across those three? Is there any particular change in focus, let's say?
So over time, we are less and less dependent or reliant on the traditional syndication.
Yes.
And I would say over the last 4 or 5 years, co-underwrite represents around 50% of the capital that we invest. Syndication or traditional syndication could be around 15 to 20%. And the new area where we're growing more and more, that is the innovative part that I was mentioning before, is what we call midlife.
Yes.
Which is the third category that we wanted to share today with you. Midlife, for lack of a better name, we chose that name because the company has already been owned by the private equity fund for a while.
Yeah.
And there is an event that requires more capital.
Yeah.
The paramount example is when their immediate competitor comes up for sale.
Yeah. Right?
The private equity manager probably has not reserved enough capital for making that acquisition. So that's when they ring certain dedicated co-investors that they have the capabilities to put capital, not at the beginning, not at the original valuation, but at a different valuation in order to make the acquisition, strike synergies, and exit down the road.
Yeah. And so they're bringing in these extra investors. It's maybe not the most ideal thing that they wanted at the start, but there's still benefits for them, though.
Well, absolutely, because it's extremely accretive for them and also will facilitate and accelerate the path to an exit.
Yeah.
If you are number three and you're able to buy number two, suddenly you become number two at exit. And that will command a premium when you're selling, rather than if you're still the number three at exit, you're going to keep the price of number three.
And I think we spoke about this a while ago, about, I suppose, continuation funds as well, and where it can strike a valuation as well at that co-invest. And that's probably another feature as well.
That's another feature of midlife. So the Paramount example I just mentioned, it's a capital injection. But connecting with what we were saying before, sometimes we approach the companies. Recently, we approached a U.S. manager. They have invested in a very good company that has been growing for a long period of time, and they invested through two funds.
Yes.
A 2016 vintage fund and a 2019 fund.
Yes.
Right? And so we are in 2024, right? It's time for that 2016 fund to divest.
Yes.
So approach them and say, look, we have a solution for your older fund. Would you like us, you know, to transact? We give you a valuation, obviously. From our perspective, it's not going to be a full control valuation price. So it removes tension from the negotiation because we're a minority. And they thought it was a good idea. They worked with us for a while, and now we're co-investors alongside the newer fund, and we're aligned for the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And they, on their side, they have removed the pressure of having an old fund still invested in the same company for 8 years.
There's a lot of innovation in this space as well, you know, and transaction types. It's quite fascinating. And so we've talked about that, you know, from a GP perspective, but what about the LP, the investor? Like, what are some of the benefits that investors get in participating in these transactions, let alone access to the deal?
So if you, when you invest in primaries, as we were mentioning before, what you're doing is a commitment into a blind pool of capital.
Blank sheet of paper.
Exactly.
Yeah, you don't know what.
You trust them that they're going to be buying good companies. But you have two problems. One, you don't know if they're going to be good companies, and you don't have a say about that. And second, you don't know when are they going to do so.
Yeah.
On co-investments, it's very capital efficient, and you also have more control around
it. Line of sight.
Exactly. You see what is the company. Yeah. You can see what the company has been doing, and you can make your own mind around it.
Mm.
Right? Once you make the commitment on primary basis, you cannot say, hey, I really don't like that company that you bought. Right? It is what it is. Here, you can choose. And then at the same time, you can analyze many more opportunities globally at the same time, so you can put more capital to work fast. And that otherwise you would not be able to do that. Now, as I'm inferring already, it's very human resources intensive, right? If you really want to analyze a lot of opportunities and make a decision, actually, you really have the capabilities, but also the team. For instance, at Neuberger Berman, we receive 11 co-investment opportunities per week.
Yeah.
So our investment committee needs to meet 3 times just to deal with all the all the deal teams, like myself, that I lead some from Europe, to give answers, feedback, and approach that. And we can be very selective as well, right? The more the funnel, the bigger it is, the better for selectivity. So we choose around 10% of what we see.
Yeah. And what about on the fee structure as well, too?
That's another interesting point. Look, we have other pockets of capital that are making those primary commitments. Yep. So we're paying full fees and carrying.
Yep. And what's the, for the listeners' benefit, what's the rough numbers?
So rough numbers, management fee, it's around 1.5% to 2% per annum.
Yep.
On committed basis, usually during the investment period, which is usually half of the term of the fund. And then the carried interest is around 20%. That's actually a pretty fixed number.
So people may have heard about 2 and 20 type.
The 2 and 20, famous. That's the 2 of the management fee and the 20 of the carried interest. And the carried interest is 20% of the capital gain that they get, assuming that you get it over an 8% pref return, which usually they get there.
Yeah. And under these transactions, the 2 and 20 does not necessarily occur for co-investors.
Correct.
Yeah.
Usually what happens, if you are already an investor in the fund or in some of other funds of the GP, they waive the management fee and carried interest for you.
That's crazy.
So in that sense, it's free.
Yeah.
Now, if you're not, if you don't have any primary commitment to that GP, you very well be paying probably a 1% and 10% carried interest. But it's a little bit logic. You don't have any other business with that general partner. So And to be honest, there are some co-investors that they just do that. They say, look, we don't have the capital to make fund commitments, but still it's a better proposition paying 110 than 220.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus they have the ability to choose what investments do they invest in.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very interesting element out of that there. And so let's bring this all together and kind of bring it to life via a deal example. So what's been one of your favorite deals that you've done in as a co-invest?
Yeah, look, there is now the largest European non-food discount retailer called Action. This is originally a Dutch company. It was acquired originally by 3i PLC, which is a publicly listed trust in the UK. And they invested originally in 2011, and they grew it. You cannot even imagine how much they grew it, but from being just one country to many countries, extended to the right and to the left of Europe. So they're in Germany and Poland, they're in the Benelux, they're in France, and now they are extending into Spain, Italy, Slovenia, Slovakia. Anyway, they invested it from a fund, and by 2019, it was obvious that they will need to liquidate that fund. They had already exhausted all the extensions, so they had to move that investment somewhere else. They wanted to reinvest. So they invited another GP, in this case was Hellman & Friedman, to crystallize what was going to be the valuation, and co-investors, because it was a very big investment on their side. And we invested very heavily, a couple hundred of millions into that company. Obviously, we knew it very well as a fund investor into that fund.
Okay.
Right?
So, yeah, okay, you were in a primary.
We were a primary investor, so we knew around it. That's why we were investor.
Yeah.
That's why we were invited to be a co-investor.
Nice.
And we invested very happily because we saw the trajectory. And look, they just started into Spain. In France, they have 650 plus stores. Mm. In Spain, they have two.
Wow.
And the size of the two countries for everyone listening, they are very similar.
Yes.
So there's no, in Italy, the same. So there's no reason why this should keep increasing. They have more than 2,500 stores. They have never had to shut down a store because it's not working.
Yeah.
That's a proof of concept.
Yes.
The average basket is less than €6. You don't find anything there. Sorry, you don't find anything in Amazon that is being sold there. Cheaper on Amazon,
okay,
which is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then on top of that, they have
it's a rare story to see let's say a bricks and mortar store fight back in a
exactly
way.
Yeah. Very, fighting back very well.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, they have borrowed also some concepts of I would say campaigns. So they have the Halloween campaign, the Christmas campaign, the summer campaigns. So they have specific articles that they are very useful for those moments. And then the Zara. And women will know more about this. Every 2 weeks, 40% of the assortment is changed.
Wow. Yeah.
So you really want to go back and say, hey, what's new here?
Yeah.
Right? So they keep traffic into the stores. Anyways, we're extremely happy of how is that going. If you visit the website of 3i PLC, this is public information, but the company has more than doubled in value since we joined, or since we invested, sorry, or joined the consortium. And we're very happy. We're going to stay there for a while, probably, as the company keeps growing 30% year on year.
Yeah. And also some of your co-investment, did that lead to the expansion now into like Mediterranean countries? Was that part of the plan?
It was part of the plan, to support them while keeping very or relatively low leverage.
Yeah.
Also to redoing the capital structure, obviously, new investors, old investors, old fund, new investors, etc.
Yeah. It's great to get so close to a company, growing there like that and being an investor along the way. So well done. And so we'll just start to finish off. We've spoken a lot about our co-investment thing. That was wonderful. But we'll get into some other topical issues around private equity whilst you're here. So what are some of the common discussions or some of the common talking points that investors are asking you about what's going on in private equity at the moment?
Yeah, so two comes to my mind, valuations.
Yes.
Where valuations are they coming down, up, right, left? The short answer are for good assets, valuations are still, I would say, full.
Yep.
But these are assets that they are growing double digits top line. And with very little volatility. So valuations are not changing dramatically. However, they're starting to go down slowly, more in geographies like Europe than in the US. In the US, look, it's the largest market by private equity. There's plenty of capital out there chasing very good assets. So the slowdown or the decrease in valuations is not really meaningful. But for good assets, the valuations are relatively fulsome. So that is one topic that we get a lot of questions, and that's the current status or answer. And the other one is about, hey, distributions from general partners, from funds, they have slowed down because the number of exits have been dramatically reduced over the last year. And we're talking about liquidity.
Yes.
And here, the message that I want to send is that general partners are listening. They are looking for ways to provide liquidity and distributions to their limited partners. But we also need to understand then that the IPO market is shut. And they don't want to sell their very good assets at valuations that they don't think are the appropriate ones, right? So they may wait one more year, grow the EBITDA a little bit more, and then sell into a more reasonable valuation. And this is what we are starting to see now. Or, and that's why we are very active these days, we are structuring with them deals where they sell a little bit of their company, call it 5, 10, 15%. They keep full control of it. They keep the company for longer, but they are able to turn back to their LPs and say, look, this is a distribution.
Yeah. You can take some original capital.
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
Chips off the table.
Yeah.
And probably cost back of the original investment and a way of increasing distributions.
Yeah.
So I would expect 2024 to have a greater number of distributions than what has been 2023 on the back of, look, one more year of company's growth that, you know, may help on bridging the gap between valuations, buyer and seller, but also groups like ourselves that we're helping them facilitating other ways to access liquidity.
Yeah. I imagine you're doing that through co-invest.
Correct. Through co-invest.
Back to the top.
But also on the GP-leds that we were mentioning before, that's another way of for them to seek liquidity.
Yeah, that's interesting. And probably on valuation, you made me think about it. I suppose there have been a lot of questions around valuation methodology as well, too. So has there been a lot of introspection and review on how – let's talk about yourself, for example. You can't talk about everyone in market, about what you're doing around your own valuation methodologies.
Yeah, look, the first thing that we do before investing in any manager, in any strategy, primaries, co-investments, or secondaries, we do a due diligence or operational due diligence on their valuation policy.
Yes.
And we try to understand how do they value, how frequently, how robust are their processes. Once that has been validated and that they follow normal standard valuation methodologies, we generally take their value or their valuations on quarterly basis almost like a face value as long as they are within the boundaries, right? We have a range for it, all of the companies. If it's within that range, look, they can apply the multiples of that quarter, as selected multiples because they're more focused or different ones. But as long as they're within those boundaries, we take that. Now, for more dynamic funds that they have, I would say, more frequent valuations on our side, so for instance, our semi-liquid funds that we need to publish valuations every month. And for our listeners, usually private equity, they report on quarterly basis. So there is obviously there is a gap. Then we have developed internal methodologies, basically regression models about how should we think about it. The main predictor is going to be public markets. So there is an adjustment. And doing backtesting on our model, or we have been able to predict with 95% accuracy, so only 5% plus or minus for those valuations. But generally speaking, look, valuations are relatively fair, but in the end, they need to sell.
Yes.
Now, this is on the private equity market. I want to just make a remark. Venture capital, where you don't have revenues. Sorry. Well, in some companies, you don't have revenues. And in most companies, you don't have profits or EBITDA. Then valuations are a little bit more wild.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
A large of range, let's say.
Very large range. And it's very difficult to say whether it's a reasonable valuation or not. Because in the end, what happens is that you're going to need to wait until the next valuation round to see whether investors, they buy that.
Yeah.
If that is the metric
that's
been used.
And that's about your only marker, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or if you go to IPO, exactly.
Yeah, very interesting. That was an amazing trip around the world with one of the world's leading experts on private equity, José Luis González Pastor. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you.
Praemium Limited is the issuer of the Investment Leaders and Advice Leaders podcasts. These podcasts are for promotional purposes only and aren't tailored to individual financial situations and do not contain financial advice. Views expressed by presenters may not align with Praemium's. For more information about Praemium, including our disclosure documents, please visit our website. We recommend that individuals seek professional financial advice before taking action.